Hi folks, my name is Chris and I'm the artist and co-founder at Explorer Maps. My brother Greg and I produced our first map about 11 years ago doing the map of Montana, and our list of maps has grown from one to our current tally of over 65.
Which map will you get to help you treasure your own special times? Please be sure to use the promo code Mandela for a discount when you visit exploremaps.com.
Welcome to The Trail Less Traveled, an adventure radio series and podcast dedicated to collecting stories and sounds from around the world in order to take you back to mankind's earliest form of entertainment, storytelling. This episode was recorded on location in collaboration with Explorer Maps. Missoula, Montana is a mecca for outdoor enthusiasts, and each week we will bring you tales of adventure from both near and far, as well as information and inspiration and a few tunes to set the mood. You can subscribe to the podcast and learn about our international outreach projects at traillesstraveled.net. And now, here's your host, international expedition guide, conservationist, and yogi, Mandela.
This afternoon, The Trail Less Traveled is being recorded in Moab, Utah. We are at the offices of Canyonlands Natural History Association, and I'm sitting here with the executive director, Sam Wehner. Sam is an outdoor enthusiast and supporter of public lands. He was voted in the top 100 of the Sierra Club's environmental heroes. Sam, I'm so stoked to be sitting with you right now. I got to say that I'm a little bit sweaty because I just literally came from Landscape Arch in the park. It's a beautiful day. But yeah, first and foremost, thank you so much for your time and energy.
You're welcome. I'm glad that you're here. I'm glad to participate in your storytelling.
You yourself are also a storyteller. And I just want to remind folks listening that Sam is not only the executive director of the Canyonlands Natural History Association, he also is a community DJ here in Moab on KZMU Community Radio. He's coached basketball and soccer, and he's also chaired the Moab Area Travel Council Advisory Board from 2013 to 2015 and served as president of the Peaks, Plateaus, and Canyons Association. So my first question for you, Sam, is where did you grow up and how was adventure and conservation a part of your childhood?
I grew up in High Point, North Carolina. My whole family is still back in North Carolina. And my first memories of outdoor adventures was going up on family picnics on Sunday afternoons and taking a ride on the Blue Ridge Parkway. And at the time, I didn't even realize that the Blue Ridge Parkway was part of the national park system. I just thought it was a cool place to go. It was my introduction to the outdoors, and we would have good, great family time. Growing up, I didn't have a whole lot to do with the outdoors aside from these family picnics. I was in the Boy Scouts and got introduced to camping that way. But when I was in college in the mountains of Banner Elk, North Carolina, I was sitting around with some friends, and a good friend of mine said, "Hey, how would you like to go to Estes Park, Colorado next summer? I can get us all a job and a place to live before we leave." And at that point, the furthest west I'd ever been in my whole entire life was the Cleveland, Ohio airport. I was like, "Sign me up. I want to go to Colorado. That sounds great." So a week before I left on the trip, I bought my first 35 millimeter film camera and traveled with four other buddies out to Estes Park, Colorado, where we had a job with the concessionaire on the south end of the park, National Park Village South in Estes Park, Colorado. And it was my introduction to the Rocky Mountains. I'd never been out west before, as I said, and it just kind of blew my mind, really, to having all of Rocky Mountain National Park as my back door to play in the summer was phenomenal, and it changed my whole life. It snowed a foot on June 7th. I'd never seen a foot of snow at any one time, you know, probably only a couple times in my life. It snowed a foot on June 7th, which also was pretty phenomenal, and it was just a great introduction to the outdoors for me. wandering around the park and taking pictures kind of started to mold my life as to what I wanted to do and where I wanted to be. And I knew that I wanted to be out west. The park spoke to me so greatly, and just being outdoors all summer long, being at elevation, climbing 14,000 foot peaks, as a 19-year-old from North Carolina, it was a game changer for sure. So I returned to North Carolina in 1980, but knowing that I wanted to be in Colorado, I wanted to go to school for photography. I loved photography. I loved Colorado. This was way before the internet. All I knew was that there was a 2-year school somewhere in Colorado that offered a photography program. So after hours of research in the library, I found out that Colorado Mountain College out of Glenwood Springs, Colorado, actually had a 2-year fine art photography program. And so in 1981, I moved to Glenwood Springs and went through this program. My journeys took me from Glenwood Springs to the San Francisco Bay Area. And in 1987, I hiked about 400 miles on the Pacific Crest Trail. So it was basically what we call the John Muir Trail Plus. So we started at South Lake Tahoe and finished the whole trip on Mount Whitney, on top of Mount Whitney, on my birthday, October 22nd, in a whiteout. That's a different story for sure. But so this hike on the John Muir Trail was what became a warm-up hike for a hike on the Continental Divide. So I'm a through hiker on the Continental Divide, 1990. I went with a good friend of mine, Stephen Capra. His job at the time was to give presentations on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the importance of specifically the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. He came up with this idea that we would make this an awareness hike for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So our motto was hiking through wilderness for wilderness, as we were trying to get wilderness designation for the coastal plain. And we started at Antelope Wells, New Mexico, and ended up at Glacier National Park at the Canadian border, Glacier Waterton. And along the way, we were given these presentations. We actually stopped in Wyoming at the National Outdoor Leadership School's headquarters in Lander, Wyoming, and we spoke to several of their trips that were getting ready to take off for their month-long journey into the backcountry. And that really spoke to me as far as like inspiring these young people. And I was 30 at the time, not old, but not young, inspiring these, you know, 19, 21-year-old into opportunities in engagement in the backcountry or opportunities to be involved in some type of environmental issue. It spoke to them, it spoke to me. I decided I wanted to go back to school, so I applied to Sonoma State University from the trail, from hiking the Continental Divide Trail. When I got to Salmon, Idaho in my general delivery mail, I had an acceptance letter from Sonoma State University. And so when I finished the Continental Divide hike, that was in October of 1990, and in January 1991, I attended Sonoma State University, where 2 years later, I received a bachelor's in outdoor and environmental education. Mm-hmm. I taught in California at several different residential environmental education programs, where they would take inner city kids and mix them with rural kids and to an outdoor experience, I'll call it. So it was called Caritas Creek. It was in Occidental, California, so north of San Francisco. They would bring inner city Oakland and San Francisco kids up and mix them in cabin groups with rural kids from Petaluma and Santa Rosa and all these little communities around where we were living. It was an amazing experience. I didn't have to be a counselor. They would bring high school kids up to do that. So all I had to do was teach. And so we had a Redwood Ecology Day. We had a Creek Ecology Day because there was a creek that ran through the property. And then we would take them to the ocean and do an Ocean Ecology Day. And it was just an amazing experience where you would see these inner city kids that on the first day of the program wouldn't sit down on the ground because they didn't want to get their butts dirty, and end up on day three letting me and other kids bury them in pine needles to feel what it was like to be part of the forest floor. And I loved teaching. It was a great molding of who I became today. I did that for several years. And at the same time, I was also working for the National Wildlife Federation for their teen adventure backpacking program out of Snowmass, Colorado. So I love being in the field. I love it. You know, being outdoors, that's what it was all about for me at that time. And so, how did I get to Moab? At the time, I was dating a woman who I met at Sonoma State University. She was a Student Conservation Association intern at Natural Bridges National Monument in 1994, and she actually worked for CNHA a year before I did because we had a position down at Natural Bridges National Monument, and she had that position in 1995. Well, we decided we didn't want to be apart anymore, so we actually decided to move to Moab. So in February 1996, we came to Moab. We had put out feelers. I had contacted CNHA in December. She had contacted the Park Service. They both said, come back in February. That's when we did our hiring. So came back in February. I got hired by CNHA as a seasonal employee, 3 days in the warehouse and 2 days at the island in the sky. And my now wife, Heidi, was hired by the Park Service as an interpreter up at the island in the sky. And that began my career here at CNHA. I'd been working seasonally for many, many years. In the summer of 1997, I was approached by the executive director at that time. And he said, you know, I don't know if you want full-time employment, but we want to offer you this position as our warehouse manager. And I said, I don't know if I want full-time employment either, but I'll take the job. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I landed here. That's how I ended up with CNHA. And then over the years, that position for me just kind of morphed from warehouse manager into inventory specialist, into operations manager, which I held that position for quite some time. I'm not exactly sure how long. And then I was just recently named the executive director beginning in October of last year, of 2023.
That is the voice of Sam Wehner. He is the executive director of Canyonlands Natural History Association. And when you work in conservation, you learn that there are a lot of acronyms. So when we say CNHA, that's what we're referring to. And I want to take people back to this place and connect them with this place. So Sam, why do you live here and why is this place so special?
Well, that's a great question. I live here for many reasons. Everything that I want in my life converges here in Moab. I spent a lot of my early 20s in Colorado and in California and alpine environments. Moab has the Manti-La Sau National Forest, which a lot of people don't realize is the second highest mountain range in Utah, with the tallest peaks just under 13,000 feet. So we've got the alpine environment. We've got the Colorado River that cuts right across the northern part of town and that affords boating opportunities. And I've done numerous trips, canoe trips down the Green River and through Canyonlands to the confluence of the Colorado River. It has the deserts and the canyons and the arches. And so what is an arch? An arch, by definition, is an opening in a sandstone layer of rock here in Moab. And it has to be at least 3 feet in any direction to actually be called an arch. So you might see, you know, a little crack or something that's about 18 inches long and 3 inches wide. And by definition, that's not truly an arch. One day it probably will be, but it has to be 3 feet in any direction, an opening. So think of an arch as a window into another time or place if you want, but it's a window or an opening. This might sound a little funny, but I first came to Moab in 1982 when I was living in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. I was very green to the outdoors. I was very green to camping and hiking and that kind of thing. But Moab spoke to me. The stillness, the quietness of this remote areas where you go out to Grandview Point, maybe in the wintertime right now because our visitation has exploded, but you go out and there's nobody around and you listen to the silence. You don't get silence that much anymore, no matter where you go. You can be out there and just listen to the wind, listen to the ravens talk to you, listen for a rabbit hopping through the bushes. It's one of my favorite things to do, is just go and sit and observe and become one with the place. I lived in California for 10 years. One of my most favorite places on earth is the Redwoods, the Redwood Forest. And it's such a special place. It's so ancient to me. And the first time that I was in the Redwoods, I got this same feeling, this inner feeling of ancient wisdom, which is the same feeling that I get in walking through the canyons of this area. You couldn't have two more diverse ecosystems in a redwood forest or a desert environment, but yet they speak to me in the same way. And I think that that's special. I think that's something special that our national park system offers, is that opportunity for people to go out and experience themselves in nature and discover themselves in nature and find out things about themselves that they may not ever get in touch with in the other place in the country or the world. So Moab is unique that we have two national parks, Arches and Canyonlands National Parks. That Arches is a 10-minute drive from downtown Moab. Canyonlands, the Island and the Sky District, is, you know, 45-minute drive. Neal's District is a little over an hour. But another one of my most favorite places is a little further south of here, but it's also in an area that CNJ helps to administer, is Cedar Mesa and what is now Bears Ears National Monument. I've gone there every year that I've been here. I go at least once in the spring, once in the fall. You talk about ancient wisdom, and there's definitely a lot of ancient wisdom down in the greater Cedar Mesa area. I love the sandstone. I think it's beautiful. The banded red and white kind of stripes that you get in Cedar Mesa. And it's also the primary layer of rock formation in the Needles District of Canyonlands National Park.
You just mentioned ancient wisdom. And after we're done recording, we're going to head back out into the wind. That's why we're not recording outside right now.
It is a windy day.
Yeah. We're going to head to Moab, man. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the people who have been living here for thousands of years.
They have. And just like Moab right now is a melting pot convergence area for a lot of different people, it was kind of a crossroads for different ancestral communities, not at the same time, but as people moved through this area. And so there was the Fremont culture that was very prevalent here. And before that, there was the Bear Canyon people, which if you look at the rock imagery that's up at Sago Canyon, that's all Bear Canyon style. And Horseshoe Canyon of Canyonlands National Park, the Great Gallery, that's Bear Canyon style. And then you have the ancestral Puebloan people that came through here, vacated the area about 700 years ago. They were here from like 1300 to 700 AD. And so there's been a lot of cultural communities that have used this area for a long, long time. They may not have necessarily lived right here in Moab, but you see, as you mentioned, we're going to go look at some imagery in just a little bit, but you see that they pass through here quite a bit, or you might find a granary or some kind of food storage system, or you might be fortunate enough to find a dwelling. And that's one thing that I like about exploring down on Cedar Mesa and Bears Ears, is the past, that ancient past, that ancestral Puebloan presence, where one of my most favorite things to do is to just walk and look and see what you can find. Just stumbling onto a potsherd, you know, that's 900 years old. Of course, not taking it, leaving it right where it was found, but just finding it and knowing that I'm looking at something that was created almost 1,000 years ago and that people lived here and lived in this environment. There were more people here then than there are now. There was anywhere between 65,000 to close to possibly 200,000 people living down in the Cedar Mesa area. You know, the population of Moab right now is 5,000. Grand County's 10. I don't even know what San Juan County is, but there was a thriving community here 900 years ago, which is fun to explore.
Yeah. It's a delight to look out the window and see the color of the purple sky as it changes to the sunset and the rock changes from red to dark blue. And speaking of that, you know, this is a radio show. This is a podcast. The people listening, they don't know where you are right now. So let's just sit up, stretch our legs, maybe open the window. And using words, can you paint the picture as to what's outside right now and what's past these buildings? And as you look to the north?
Well, to the north is the Sand Flats Recreation Area. So that's area that is great to explore in, and it's actually got four-wheel drive backcountry roads. It's got mountain bike trails up in there. You can hike up in there. It's managed by the BLM and Grand County, so I can see the Sand Flats from here. If I look far north, because I know where it is, I can actually see Arches National Park from my office window. Looking to the west is the Moab Rim. So the cliffs of the Moab Rim that rise up from here are almost 900 feet from Highway 191. We're really looking at the access to Hidden Valley and the Behind the Rocks area, which are lands that are administered by the BLM. And you can't see it from my current office. My old office had this amazing view of the LaSalle Mountains in this time of year and at this time of day when that late afternoon sun rakes across those snow-covered peaks. That's where I know I'm home.
I looked at that yesterday when I came out of the fiery furnace. I just had to stop for almost 40 minutes and watch as the colors shifted. So that's beautiful. All right. Well, Sam, I heard you mention a few things that I think we could elaborate on. Not taking pottery shards, not taking arrowheads from the national park. But it doesn't just stop there. We've got beautiful cryptobiontic soil as well in this part of the world. And so I just wanted to highlight how much Canyonlands Natural History Association is helping Arches and Canyonlands and your other partners as more and more people visit the national parks. Some of the tips that you might have for someone who's visiting to make sure that they take care of these resources for future generations.
Well, and I also just want to remind people, too, that it's not just national parks. So on any public lands, you know, that you're exploring or recreating, and there's actually the Antiquities Act. And so any kind of artifact that you find is covered, and it's a federal law to remove anything. Mm-hmm. You can look at things. You can pick up a pottery shard, but put it back where you found it. You're not supposed to touch rock imagery because the oils in your hands can degrade. If it's a pictograph, the oils can degrade the pigments that were used to paint that. And even if it's a pictograph, which was an image that was pecked into the rock, your oils will degrade it as well. And so don't touch any rock imagery. You shouldn't touch any kind of dwelling or construction that you find, a granary. Again, you might accidentally knock it over. Oils degrade, and observe with your eyes, you know, the truly leave no trace concept. Take pictures and observe with your eyes. So we have a very unique soil crust here. It's changed names over the years. Right now, the current terminology is biological soil crust, but it was also known as cryptogamic soil crust, and we just call it crypto for short. You know, tiptoe through the crypto or don't bust the crust, but it's actually the sign of a very healthy desert ecosystem. So the biological soil crust is the foundation for any kind of plant life in the area. And so it looks like it could be dark in color, looks like little lumpy soil, and it does almost have a crust on it, which is why it's called biological soil crust or crypto soil crust. But it's very fragile. And so if you have a whole group of people that are out hiking and you see something pretty cool and you want to, oh, let's just cut across, you know, this field, well, the field could be full of soil crust and your footsteps will destroy the crust. And so the thing out of it is like you're, in essence, destroying life. You want to explore the area as clean as possible. We always make it a game almost. It's like I had a good buddy who lived here where we would just go in the backcountry all the time and we would challenge anybody to find where we went. Because we were definitely off trail, but you stay in washes. You stay in wash bottoms that are going to get, you know, cleaned out by any kind of rain. Or if you have to wander out of the wash bottom, then you stay on rock as much as possible. Or even just a small little drainage, anything where water is going to flow to cover up your steps and your tracks. And so just as you're recreating in the area, be aware of those types of things that everywhere you go, you have the potential for creating impact. Could be a dry pothole that once wet, life emerges, you know, once there's water in these potholes. And so I even avoid walking through potholes. I'll go around them. A pothole, you know, is a depression in the rock that when it rains will fill up with water. And that means life to not only the creatures that might be buried in the sand waiting for that water, but it is also, you know, for coyotes and mountain lions and foxes and bighorn sheep, any of the birds need that clean source of water too. So just be aware, it is a fragile environment. Some people say it could be a hostile environment. I was thinking about this when you were talking about, oh, I could live in Moab. And, you know, Moab's different from Missoula because Missoula probably doesn't hit 117 in the summer. You know, it can be that hot here. It can easily be 110 degrees every day. So be prepared, too, when you're hiking out in this country. If it's in the summertime, go early in the day and carry at least a gallon of water, 4 liters of water with you wherever you go. Let people know where you're going, if you're traveling by yourself, and recreate responsibly.
Hi, folks. My name is Chris, and I'm the artist and co-founder at Explorer Maps. My brother Greg and I produced our first map about 11 years ago, doing the map of Montana, and our list of maps has grown from 1 to our current tally of over 65. I've been drawing and painting for a long, long time, starting as an advertising illustrator in the 80s back in Canada, to exhibiting wildlife and landscape oil paintings in East Africa through the 1990s. But I find that what I'm doing now with Explorer is the most rewarding project I've ever been involved with, mostly because it's a family business, and helping to grow that business gives me a real sense of purpose. We've even got our daughter Becca in on the action, making short documentaries and videos. She's just done one of Costa Rica. And my wife Ness will be finding new markets for our Explorer products when we move back to Kenya in the summer. So that'll be great fun. On the topic of connecting people in place, hopefully these maps bring back memories of great holidays and fun with family and friends. And it makes people want to get out there and connect or reconnect with these places. Do I have a favorite map? I definitely do not have a favorite map. They're all my favorites because they're like my children. I love them all equally. How's that for a diplomatic answer? Anyway, thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Vanessa, Chris's wife. Which map will you get to help you treasure your own special times? Please be sure to use the promo code Mandela for a discount when you visit exploramaps.com.
I'm sitting here with Sam Wehner. He is the executive director for CNHA. And Sam is an outdoor enthusiast and supporter of public lands. He has a BA in outdoor education and environmental studies. And he was one of the Sierra Club's top 100 environmental heroes. Kenyanlands Natural History Association is a nonprofit organization which exists solely to assist the National Park Service, the U.S. Forest Service, and the Bureau of Land Management in their education and visitor efforts. Proceeds from sales support these agencies' educational, interpretive, and scientific programs on the Colorado Plateau. They have been around since 1967. Man, there's a lot to talk about here, Sam, and I just want to dive in and see where you would like to start. Maybe starting with some of the accomplishments or the journey. I know that I've been spending a lot of time with nonprofits that support the parks, and it seems like there's been also an evolution in the names. I'm not sure if that has been a case here too. So I just want to hand it over to you and highlight the beautiful things that are being done by Canyonlands Natural History Association.
I think you bring up a good point, and we'll start with that as far as the names and the changing of names. And people get really confused when they hear our name, Natural History Association, and they don't even understand what that is. But they think that we might have something to do with natural history, or they think that we're a museum, or they're just really not sure exactly what we do. A lot of parks like Yellowstone has changed their name. They were a Natural History Association. Grand Canyon Conservancy was Grand Canyon Natural History Association. Smokies, Great Smoky Mountain, just changed their name like last week to Smokies Life. So you're seeing a lot of these organizations getting away from that nomenclature. We have not yet. We're unique in what we do. There are these sister associations throughout the whole country. They're all nonprofit organizations that support the parks that they're located in. We are a little bit unique in that we not only partner with the National Park Service, but we partner with the Forest Service and the BLM. We have a statewide agreement with the State of Utah Bureau of Land Management, which enables us to actually partner with any BLM office in the whole entire state, although our focus is the Southeast region. And then, as I said, we also partner with the Manti-LaSalle National Forest. Mm-hmm. We've looked into changing our name. We haven't been able to come up with a name that actually we like better that represents all three agencies. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and as you mentioned, we exist to support the science and education efforts of our federal partners. We are not a philanthropic organization, even though we're a nonprofit. And what I mean by that is that we do not have a fundraising arm or a branch. There's a friends group, Friends of Arches and Canyonlands National Parks. And a lot of these name changes that you've seen, like Grand Canyon Conservancy or Zion Forever Project, are organizations that had dual missions. They had a fundraising arm, or at one point merged within their organization with that fundraising arm. And that's where some of these name changes have come from. So the money that we donate back to our federal partners comes through sales at our National Park Service Visitor Center stores. The Forest Service doesn't have any stores that we operate for them in Southeast Utah. The BLM has the Cane Gulch Ranger Station, which is a contact point for Bears Ears National Monument and for the Cedar Mesa Recreation Area. And then we also have a tiny little sales presence at the Hanksville, Utah BLM office. As far as our reach goes, is west of here up into the Henry Mountains and also to the San Rafael Swell. Mm-hmm. But our main area of focus is in Southeast Utah. We represent Arches and Canyonlands National Parks, Natural Bridges, Hovenweep, and Bears Ears National Monuments. So the money that we generate in our stores, the proceeds go back to these partners, and we are limited because we're not a philanthropic organization. We have specific guidelines through the Department of Interior on what we can support, and those items are education and research and science. So we can't fund maintenance. You hear a lot these days about the maintenance backlog in the national parks, but that's not within our mission, and it wouldn't actually be an approved project by Intermountain Region National Park for us to be able to fund. So everything that we fund actually gets approved by our board of directors, but it also has to be approved by the National Park Service Regional Office. So what do we fund? We fund things like Canyon Country Outdoor Education. That's one of the biggest programs that we fund. It's a great program in Grand and San Juan County, Utah, where they take local elementary school kids, actually starting kindergarten, but really grades first through sixth, onto field trips, onto public lands to help the teachers meet their state core science curriculum. And it serves dual purpose because it obviously helps the schools and helps the teachers get their science taught, but it also introduces local kids, and not only the kids, but the parents, because the parents can attend the field trips as chaperones, but it introduces them to the public lands in their backyard. And it also puts a really good community face for the Park Service to the local community. And it's a great relationship because kids, it's a small town, it's a small community. So kids that have gone through this program see one of the rangers in the grocery store and they run up to this ranger and they're like, look, it's Ranger Heidi, or it's Ranger Joan, and she took me into the fiery furnace. And it's a really good feeling all the way around for those teachers, for the parents, because they know that their kids have now been connected, you know, to their backyard. And even the parents that come on these field trips, even though they live here, they may not have been in the park for 10, 12, 15 years. They're like, oh my gosh, I haven't been here in so long. So it's a good program, helps with science, but it also is a very, very community involved program. So that's one of the programs that we fund. We fund it every year. We fund things like the Junior Ranger programs for the national parks. CNHA several years ago bought telescopes for all three districts of Canyonlands National Park, so Island Sky, Needles, Mays District, for Natural Bridges and Hovenweep National Monument. And just last year, we actually bought a telescope for Bears Ears National Monument. So the rangers, the interpretive staff, can conduct night sky and dark sky programs. They have dark sky events. There's an astronomy festival here now every year that's put on jointly with the Park Service and Dead Horse Point State Park. Last year, we had a really interesting request, and it was fairly unique. We actually funded an e-bike patrol program for the Park Service. So we helped them purchase several e-bikes so that the rangers could do these patrols as opposed to a Jeep or some kind of four-wheel drive vehicle. And some of the benefits from that program is that it's less dust when you're traveling around on these dirt roads, these backcountry roads. It's quieter. It's a lot quieter. And it was also a more friendly way to engage with the user groups that are in the backcountry. And that was a pilot program, and it's been fairly successful, and other parks are looking into being able to do that type of program as well. We funded for the U.S. Forest Service last year. We funded a position for an assistant avalanche forecaster and community development coordinator. And this person not only was involved in their avalanche forecasting, which they only had one, so it was a very important position to fill, but now they have this opportunity to engage the community in a lot of education for winterized backcountry use. So they do a Know Before You Go program. Mm-hmm. They do ski safety, avalanche safety programs in the wintertime. They do a big come wax your skis and get to know the area program. And so that was a need that the Forest Service came to us several years ago. And again, a good community position that not a lot of people are aware of, or things that we fund that actually help the community. For the BLM, last year we funded a natural resources field day for local high school students in San Juan County. We funded a first ever artist in residence program for the BLM. And for the Forest Service and the BLM, we have been funding a lot of tribal engagement. So as the management plan for Bears Ears National Monument comes online, part of the language in the proclamation was that the tribes had to be involved. And so it's been a huge asset for our partners to be able to come to us to be able to fund these types of engagements, because they don't have the base funding to do that. And it's been a huge, huge need. It's the first step of the process. They can't go any further into their management plan without having these tribal engagements first. So it's been a big focus of the partners on that level. We funded for the Park Service an Ancestral Lands Conservation Corps intern to assist the Park Service with cultural resources projects, implementing an archaeological site monitoring plan. We helped all three federal agencies last year in support of the Ring of Fire annular eclipse that occurred here in October. Huge influx of people to all of the public lands, but especially on BLM lands down in southeast Utah, which was right in the center path of the eclipse. We created some customized eclipse glasses that we made available to all three partners, the Forest Service, the BLM, and the Park Service. Park Service gave out over 7,000 pair of eclipse glasses, and some of those were multi-language. Oh, last year was Hovind Weep Centennial Celebration. They turned 100 years old, and so we were able to help them fund some of the events that they held throughout the year to help celebrate that centennial.
That's the voice of Sam Wehner, and he's the executive director for Canyonlands Natural History Association. Sam, for someone listening who doesn't really understand, you know, why the national park might not be able to raise the money the way you guys could you give a little bit of a taste as to, you know, the difference?
Well, sure. We exist because the parks aren't allowed to basically conduct business for themselves, right? So they can't operate stores themselves. They only get base funding from the federal government, which seems to be shrinking every year. And they can hold on to some of the money that's been generated through fees at their gates, but they need additional sources of funding. They just don't have the money to support all these projects that they need to do. Research is another big area that we can fund. Mm-hmm. And that leads me to another program, actually, that our board of directors developed in 2007 as a way to actually give even more money to the federal partners, and in particular, the BLM and the Forest Service, because the Park Service gets a lion's share of the money that we generate because the money is generated in their stores. But we still do support the other two agencies. But our board of directors came up with a program called the Discovery Pool, and it's a granting program to award money for scientific discovery. And so we accept proposals every year from the Park Service, the BLM, and the Forest Service research proposals, and it has to come through one of those federal agencies. Usually it's somebody working on a doctorate thesis through a university, or they're university researchers that are working on specific things throughout the area. So the Discovery Pool was founded in 2007, and with our last set of funding that just happened last month, January of this year, the board approved seven different projects. The San Jose Discovery Pool has awarded over $950,000 that goes to direct support of scientific research. And another cool thing that we've done community-wise is that we have partnered with Science Moab, and we actually sponsor their Science on Tap program through the winter. They give three lectures, December, January, and February, here in town, bringing in researchers to present to the local community. And then we are also sponsoring a month series of their podcast. They do a weekly podcast, and it's been a great partnership where we provide them with our Discovery Pool recipients, and they participate in the Science Moab podcast. It's been a fun partnership. We're trying to find other ways that we can grow with them. They come to our Public Lands Day celebration every year. We have a big celebration on the plaza of the Moab Information Center where we bring all of our federal partners together and other local entities like Grand County Trail Alliance, Debtors Point State Park, Friends of Arches and Canyonlands, the community artists in the park. We just have live music. We sponsored on the Plaza of the Mick the day before National Public Lands Day, which is always in September. Mm-hmm. And Science Moab has been a partner in that for the last 2 years as well.
That is the voice of Sam Wehner, and he is the executive director for Canyonlands Natural History Association. And I'm just so happy knowing that I spent well over $100 at the gift shop the other day at the Visitor Center. I'm a book collector. And if you're listening and you're also a book collector, I recommend that you buy the books from the Visitor Centers when you visit these national parks, because you're supporting the park. Sam, what's the best way that someone listening out there can support your efforts?
You could go to our website, www.cnha.org. You can check out all kinds of things that we do. You can look at our Discovery Pool program on our website. We have a membership program. You can join CNHA at many different levels, starting at $35 and going up from there. Or if you just want to send us some money, there's a donate tab on that website too. So we do appreciate any support that you get, any donations, and also our membership dollars go directly to support all three federal agencies. We don't take an administration fee out of anything that's donated. It goes right to our programs.
Beautiful. Sam, thank you so much for joining me today on The Trail Less Traveled.
Well, thanks for having me. I was very excited that you reached out to CNHA. We appreciate the shout out and the support.
Namaste, Missoula. Mandela here, your host of The Trail Less Traveled, the Trail 1033's locally harvested adventure radio series, which premieres every Sunday night at 6 Mountain Time. And you can stream it live online at trail1033.com. The show is also a podcast available everywhere. I would like to take a moment to thank a small family business based in Missoula, Montana, for their full support of the podcast version of the show and my international outreach programs, Explore Maps. Explore Maps and the Trail Less Traveled are partnering up to connect people and place. I hope to see you for Cartography Comes Alive on March 20th, from 5:30 to 7 p.m. For the first time, I'm going to be speaking publicly about swimming 225 miles of the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon using a riverboard during the pandemic. And you can learn more by visiting exploremaps.com. That's it for this week's adventure, my friends in Missoula and around the world. Until next week, please remember, conservation isn't a spectator sport. Living in Missoula is a privilege. With privilege comes responsibility. Please get informed, get engaged, and speak up on behalf of wildlife and wild places.